From underneath the concrete jungle of Kalamazoo, anarchy on the airway.
The People's Power Hour on 89.1 WIDR.
Now, he's a spoiled brat. Tried the nice guy who was cooperating with the president.
You've got it tuned to 89.1 FM WIDR Kalamazoo. This is the People's Power Hour. Tonight our guest is Robert Jensen. He is a journalism professor at the University of Texas in Austin. I guess Eric read his bio over the air a few minutes previously. So, Bob, how's it going?
Well, I'm surviving in Texas. That's all I ever do in Texas is barely survive.
Right. It's at least you're in Austin, right?
Yeah, it's fairly livable.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a pretty involved activist.
Yeah, I'm a former journalist. I came out of mainstream journalism, went back to graduate school so I could get one of these cushy gigs as a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since being granted tenure and solidifying my position at the university, I've devoted most of my free time to political organizing and to writing that's aimed at a general audience for political purposes rather than a specialized audience for academic purposes. So, you know, I live here at the university. I teach my classes. I love the students, but my real focus is on a bigger world, which I think is important. I wish more academics would kind of engage that way because we're one of the few people left with the kind of privileges that allow it to be done fairly easily. So, interest in the anti-war movement, in ecological issues, in race and gender issues, try to range widely.
Actually, that was, if I got your bio straight, it was work, anti-pornography work from a radical feminist critique that sort of got you started in activism. Is that correct?
Yeah. When I went back to graduate school after leaving mainstream journalism, my real entry into radical politics and into a critical sort of stance toward the dominant culture was in the radical feminist critique of pornography, which, of course, always has to be distinguished from right-wing and religious critiques of pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very interesting education and a very interesting sort of entryway into critical thinking to ask a fundamental question about how, in this case, a cultural product helps shape people's experiences and what happens when that shapes experiences toward domination, toward aggression, toward even violence. Really important questions. And for me, it was just the opening of a door into a lot of questions about really the nature of what I would call the domination-subordination dynamic that structures so much of our lives, whether it's the way in which the wealthy and the privileged dominate the working class and ordinary folks and try to make that seem as if it's not only acceptable but almost natural, the way in which men play the same game with women, the way in which the dominant white culture takes that position of domination as the natural and appropriate stance for it. These are all ways of just looking at different kinds of power dynamics in similar ways and seeing that in all of them there is this domination-subordination dynamic and then an attempt by the people on top to naturalize that domination. And we have to resist that whenever we see it, of course.
You talked about, you know, having the privilege of being a tenured professor. I know right after 9/11 you had some comments that you published in an opinion piece in the Houston paper that kind of irked the administration there. Could you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, irked is a mild term. Many of us, of course, after 9/11 started speaking out right away, saying what was, I thought, obvious then is even more obvious now, which is that the attacks of 9/11 were going to be used by the Bush administration, and I must say largely with the complicity of the Democrats in Congress, were going to be used to push the United States into aggressive wars, and we've seen it twice now in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Well, those of us who said that immediately after 9/11 often had consequences. For me, the consequence was being denounced a lot and having a lot of people in the state of Texas writing to my employer suggesting that my employment be terminated, and often not in terms that polite, I might add. So the university administration here did do something that was apparently fairly unprecedented, at least since the 1950s, which was to publicly denounce a faculty member, in this case me, for my constitutionally protected free speech.
Well, congratulations.
In public. It really, I must say that it wasn't necessarily a very pleasant thing to go through, but it wasn't that big of a deal for me. It didn't affect my behavior. I continued to do my political work and write and speak the way I always had. But it was very unfortunate in another sense because, of course, it was a message to others that they better shut up or they're going to get in trouble. And so it was part of that general climate right after 9/11 in which people felt very afraid to speak what was on their minds. And that was, of course, very destructive to any notion of democracy.
And some of the groups you're involved with, the No War Collective and Third Coast Activist Coalition, can you tell us a little bit about those?
Well, the No War Collective is just a loose grouping of some of us in Austin, some who have since moved away, actually. It was just a way to name a group of people working. The more important endeavor right now is, as you point out, the Third Coast Activist Resource Center. And when I say important, I don't mean that we have grandiose ideas about, you know, leading the revolution, but that a couple of years ago, some of us in Austin decided we wanted to commit to a long-term project of building an institution. In this case, the mission of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center is really public education. We took on the task of arranging speakers, film screenings, discussions, anything where we could help bring into the public some of these critical ideas about the role of the United States around the world, whether it's military policy, economic policy. And so we've been doing that and trying to slowly build for the past 2 years the infrastructure, the communications infrastructure to make that possible. And I think for us, the important lesson in that is the importance of the long haul. We look at this work not as simply a response to the most recent crisis, although there certainly those responses are necessary. We see it as trying to build those kinds of institutions over the long haul. And I know this work is going on in lots of other communities because I'm lucky I get to travel for speaking and other reasons. And I get to see that this is happening all over the country, really. It's to some degree below the radar, certainly below the radar of the mainstream media. You won't see this reported in the CBS Evening News. But it's really very, I think, very exciting and very vibrant. And I think we all have a role. We all have a place to contribute. And that's the kind of lesson I take from my recent activities.
And any of our listeners who are interested in checking out the Third Coast Activist Alliance just to see how things are run down in Texas by some of the anti-empire movement can look at thirdcoastactivist.org. Bob, can you tell us a little bit about some events going on in your home state in Crawford, Texas lately?
Yes, I've been out of town and just got back and haven't actually been up to Crawford, but of course anybody who's paying attention to the news knows that it's really the site at this moment for the most focused attention on the anti-war movement. A lot of the people doing that work are folks I've worked with here in Austin and in Dallas and around the state. And I think it shows the importance of sticking with it. The Crawford Peace House is the center of this right now. It's literally a house in Crawford, Texas. And some activists in Dallas sort of saw the potential of having a permanent base in Crawford while Bush was president. And they did what turned out to be a very, you know, a lot of foresight. They bought a house, they renovated it, and they made it a center for peace activities. And part of what happened when Cindy Sheehan was in Crawford at the beginning, before it grew to the size it is now, is there was an institution there that could help. And I think that's an important lesson. It's just, you know, mushroomed. People, activists in Austin are now, some of them full-time, you know, shuttling back and forth with supplies and doing the organizing. And it's, you know, I think this weekend they're expecting the largest crowds ever. It's the last weekend, apparently, before Bush goes back to D.C. And the media, it has been such a phenomenon that even the mainstream media can't ignore it. And it has, I think, been very important in sort of re-energizing the anti-war movement. And, of course, it's not the end. September 24th through the 26th in D.C. is the national day of action, with big rallies, some trainings, and some lobbying visits. So there's a lot of places where people, whether it's at the local level, whether it's, you know, going to D.C., a lot of places people can contribute. I think we're at a very crucial time where if this momentum can be sustained and, in fact, expanded, I wouldn't be surprised if 6 months we're looking at a very different terrain around the war in Iraq.
That's interesting. a lot of your writing has been about dealing with American imperialism and how citizens can come. I guess I'm thinking of your book, Citizens of the Empire, and several of the articles you wrote, and how ordinary citizens that sort of come to the realization of how much imperialism is caught up in our daily lives and the affluence that our society, at all levels really enjoys. And that's different, I think, from a lot of people on, you know, during the elections, it was all just about Bush.
Right. Certainly George Bush and the Bush administration has presented very serious threats to literally the survival of the world, one might be able to say. And I think it was important to recognize the severity of that threat and to respond in some ways, even respond in electoral terms. But I think the danger is that in focusing so much on the Bush administration, we often lose track of the way in which they're, in a sense, not that different. Since the end of World War II, the United States has gone about the business of trying to run the world, and the willingness to use really amazing levels of destructive capacity of the U.S. military has been a feature of Democratic and Republican administrations alike, whether it's liberals like John Kennedy or conservatives like Richard Nixon. You know, the U.S. role in the world has been relatively stable, and it's an ugly story no matter who's in office. So I think understanding the historical context is very important, lest we run into the trap, which I think, you know, many do, that all we need to do is get rid of Bush. Well, I don't think getting rid of Bush is the answer. I don't think, you know, looking back at Bill Clinton's administration fondly is the answer. Bill Clinton pursued many of the same policies, sometimes with different strategy and tactics, but presented to the world fundamentally the same face of U.S. power, which is that we will deploy it at our discretion, not according to any moral principles or any legal principles, but simply to concentrate and try to extend U.S. power. Well, that's a sustained feature of U.S. policy, and that's what we really have to attack.
Yeah. One aspect of the book Citizens of the Empire that I found really interesting, you had a chapter where you talk about the development of American political culture in the 20th century, and you sum it up in the title of that chapter as being a case of the development of more freedom and less democracy. A lot of people use those terms interchangeably, of course, but I was just wondering if you could talk about that distinction a little bit, more freedom, less democracy.
Yeah, I've always found that one of the most striking sort of paradoxes of the 20th century, because on the one hand, we should recognize that the expansion of the scope of freedom in the United States in the 20th century was really quite dramatic. We enfranchised, by the end of the 20th century, the entire adult population of the United States. That's not a small accomplishment.
Now, right.
That's true as long as you're not African-American in Florida, I suppose, these days. But for the most part, on a number of measures, including freedom of speech and political association, the 20th century was a time of great progress. If you look back to the World War I era at the beginning of the century, the repression of political speech was just taken for granted. The Supreme Court saw no reason to stop the Wilson administration from throwing hundreds of U.S. citizens and others into jail for mere political speech. Well, that's unthinkable today, at least for the moment. We, of course, always have to make sure we're fighting to keep that level of freedom. But at the same time, I make the point in that chapter that as freedom expanded, democracy in some sense contracted. That is, if you look at the beginning of the 20th century, ordinary people were much more engaged in the dialogue and debate around politics than they are today. It was a different kind of culture. The notion that people had a right and, in fact, a role in these kinds of political debates was much more common than it is today. Today, it's a very apathetic and affluent culture that often doesn't care about politics. And, of course, if ordinary people aren't day-to-day engaged in the business of politics, you can have a formal democracy, but a democracy that really isn't very meaningful in practice. So that paradox is very important. Now, how did it happen? Why did it happen? As people gained more freedom, why did they not use it to take greater control over their own lives? Well, I think that's the story, again, as you pointed out, it's partly the story of affluence. The post-World War II U.S. was, you know, fat and happy in some sense, and that tends to depoliticize people. Also, the use of propaganda. Propaganda techniques also emerged in the 20th century and were perfected over time. And that's been an effective means of containing the real democratic impulses of people. So I think for political organizers, there's always the immediate issues that we address. It's the war, it's economic issues, it's racial justice, it's gender justice. And we need to keep an eye on those issues. But I think we also need to realize that part of what we have to do is reinvigorate a deeper sense of democracy. That is, democracy not just as voting, democracy not just as walking into a polling place once every 4 years, but democracy as a lived experience in which we demand the right to be involved in these discussions, not simply give them over to the powerful. For me, that's always at the heart of political activity, no matter what the issue of the day might be.
That's a very interesting way, I think, a good interpretation of U.S. democracy. And it seems like the style of, I guess, quote-unquote democracy that we actually want to expand to other countries.
Yes, of course. You know, democracy is a concept. It can be lived in many different ways. And we tend to be very arrogant in this country, thinking that the particular form of our democracy is superior. Well, there are some things, you know, about constitutional democracies that I think are very admirable. But we also have to constantly remember that democracy is a complex question, and it's affected by a lot of things, including, of course, the shape of an economy. And the first and most obvious observation to make about the United States is that if you have a corporate capitalist economy in which wealth is concentrated in a very narrow range of the people, well, that's going to bleed over and affect the ability of the political system to be truly democratic. Well, that's the starting point, to look at the connection between the economic and the political and start to ask the simple question, how democratic is the United States in practice again? I'm not saying the formal institutions of the United States are not democratic. They are, of course. But how does that play out in people's real lives? Well, that's the question. We tend to focus in this country on formal properties of a democracy. What's the Constitution look like? What are the elections like? And those are not trivial matters, but they don't begin to exhaust the question of how democratic a culture really is.
And on a similar note, in current affairs recently, of course, another democracy that our present administration doesn't get along with in Venezuela. And I was wondering if you heard Pat Robertson's recent comments calling
yeah,
for
I mean,
the assassination.
This takes the politically absurd to new levels. We have in Venezuela a divisive president. Certainly Hugo Chavez has his detractors, but a very popular president who we might remember was elected in a democratic election. The only problem Hugo Chavez has had in administering that mandate, of course, was when U.S.-backed coup took him out for a very small amount of time, a couple of days, really. So here you have a popular, democratically elected president in a neighboring country who has been dubbed a strongman. Now, this is the term you hear in the U.S. media, strongman Hugo Chavez. He's said to be dictatorial. Well, I suppose he's maybe dictatorial in the sense he's trying to accomplish something politically, and he's probably a very strong personality, but you could say that about George Bush, perhaps, that, you know, the way in which the Bush administration has tried to ram through its policies has a certain dictatorial character to it. I mean, it's a joke. It's not even, you know, if this were a sane society, we would be laughing at these attempts to demonize a democratically elected leader simply because U.S. policymakers don't like him. But of course, it's not a joke because there are real consequences to this. Hugo Chavez has to worry about whether U.S. power is going to be deployed against him to undermine that particular democratically elected government. And Pat Robertson, while sort of being out on the fringe a bit, I think rather than focusing on how Pat Robertson was so outrageous, we should be focusing on how what he's saying is pretty commonplace in Washington. That is, branding Hugo Chavez as a threat by virtue of the fact that we, that is, not you and me perhaps, but of course policymakers in D.C., don't like Hugo Chavez. Well, you know, in that sense, Pat Robertson and George Bush, and I might add John Kerry, have a lot in common, because during the election campaign, one of the most disturbing parts of the rhetoric of the Kerry campaign was the attempt to kind of out-hawk George Bush on Venezuela. John Kerry was talking up and down during the campaign about the threat that Hugo Chavez posed to the United States. Again, here we see it's not really the differences between Republicans and Democrats or between the, you know, reactionary right and the center that are so important. It's really what they have in common that we have to keep an eye on as well.
As a journalism professor and a former working journalist, what do you see as the best way that citizens can work to try and overcome the consolidation of media that's really a problem in terms of, you know, getting information out to people that they can act upon?
Well, I think there are, when I think of media strategy, which is, of course, central to progressive politics, the role of the mass media in this propaganda system can't be, you know, can't be ignored. We have to address the media. Well, what kind of media strategy do we need? Well, I think, as is often the case, we need a diversified strategy. We need to challenge the corporate concentration of media. We need to challenge the way in which the dominant media in this culture are all for-profit media. They're capitalist enterprises. And is often the case, we find that in the actual execution of that, democracy and capitalism are in tension. I would argue they're actually incompatible. But that is one front on which we have to act. On the same front, at the same time, we have to support independent media, community radio, independent publications, websites that do original and important investigative journalism. We have to nurture an alternative to that corporate mainstream as well. And then I think there's a third component to this that we on the left sometimes overlook. We have to engage the media on their own terms and try to get what we can in the short term. And actually, that's a lot of the work I do. I try to write op-eds, for instance, that can actually make it into a mainstream newspaper. I try to work with journalists, with reporters and editors, because no matter how, you know, awful the mainstream media is as an entity, there are individual journalists within it who are very principled people trying to do good work, and we should nurture those relationships as well. So I think of media strategy as kind of a three-legged stool. There's the critique of the media. There's the support for independent media, and then there's trying to work with the corporate media to try and, to the degree possible, use those channels to reach people. I think all of those are important.
Okay, and you've got it tuned to 89.1 WIDR. We're speaking to University of Texas Professor Robert Jensen. I was wondering what kind of projects you have coming up. You've got a new book coming out soon, is that correct?
Yes, I've been working for a number of years on issues of racial justice as well, especially trying to articulate this notion of white privilege, which of course has been an idea floating for a long time, but trying to get white people not only to think about racial discrimination, to think about how people who aren't white are often the targets in this culture, but also to think about how being white in this culture brings you privileges no matter what your personal ideas about race are. And that's culminated in a book now called The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege, which is coming out from City Lights, should be out in mid-September. It's a very small book. It's a combination of both personal reflections, often personal reflections about my own failures to fully, I think, live a racial, a more just approach to race, because that's important for white people to recognize that we mess up, that when you grow up in a racist society, when you're trained in a white supremacist society, we will make mistakes. I've certainly made my share over the years, and I try to reflect on those and learn from them. And at the same time, weave that into a more analytic and historical analysis. So it's a book, again, like all of my writing these days, it's not aimed at the academic crowd. It's really a book written for ordinary people who, I assume, just like me, are struggling to make sense of those questions around race. And that's very exciting in part just because it's such an important issue, and exciting to some degree in a terrifying way because there's a lot of myself in that book, and it's, of course, always a little frightening to talk too honestly about yourself in public. But I think that's what we need as white folks to make progress right now.
I think that's a little hard for probably a more mainstream audience to accept that the United States is a, you know, white supremacist society still today after, you know, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and the end of Jim Crow and whatnot. How would you make that argument, or how do you make it in the book?
Well, as I put forth in the book, there are, you know, basically two ways to understand why the United States is still a white supremacist society. One is just to look at the data. So in the beginning of the book, I just lay out the summary of a number of studies that show that the gaps in wealth and well-being between white America and non-white America, specifically I use some data about the gaps between white and black America, are you simply can't turn away from. On some measures of well-being, for instance, we've actually lost ground since the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. Some of the resource gaps are even wider today. Well, if you have a society in which, you know, 30 years after the end of legalized segregation is still struggling at that level, it's hard to reach any conclusion other than it's still a white supremacist society. But beyond that, I think what's really important for those of us who are white to do is actually open our ears and open our hearts to the lived experience of non-white people. I know that the things that have probably had the most important impact on me personally are when I was able to actually listen to someone who isn't white talk about what that's like, what it's like to live in a white supremacist society, and the level of threat, the level of literally fear sometimes that people have to walk in this world with. That's, you know, that's a human connection. And in that case, then the data and the statistics become real. You can feel them. And I think often we have to remember that people are moved to change politically when they feel, not just when they think. And that's, again, kind of the idea behind the book, to integrate the thinking and the feeling into a political project that can go forward. I can't think of a more important subject at this point in U.S. history.
Can you discuss a little bit the relationship between the white supremacy, the racism in U.S. society, and this continual, imperial expansion that's really been with us since the beginning of our history?
Sure. Well, of course, the original, you know, act of imperial aggression is the genocide of indigenous people, which created the United States. So we often talk about, you know, when the question's often asked, when did the U.S. become an empire? Well, was it the Spanish-American War in 1898? Was it after World War II? Well, in some sense, the answer to the question is obvious. The United States became an empire from the moment Europeans landed on this continent and began the most brutal genocide that's probably ever been recorded in human history. We should remember that the United States eliminated virtually every Indian to create this country, that by the turn of the century in 1900, there were only about 250,000 indigenous folks left in this country. It's an almost complete genocide. Well, that's the founding, you know, act of the United States. That's an act of imperial aggression that's hard to top. And, of course, it's racialized. How do you justify killing that many people? Well, because they're not fully human. They're not really like us. You look at African slavery, the deep, deep racist tenor of African slavery. That's one of the most important realities that propelled the United States into the Industrial Revolution. That we have to come to terms with. And, of course, in the post-World War II era, it's been a different kind of racialized project. That is, the United States didn't go about the business of, you know, destroying Southeast Asia by saying, well, these Vietnamese people really aren't human. But it was much easier to go about the business of destroying Southeast Asia when the victims were not white. I think this has long been understood that you can mobilize the American people, that is the dominant white society in the United States, to support acts of imperial aggression around the world when the targets are not white. And I think, you know, we saw that one of the most important, you know, sort of recognitions that came out of the Vietnam War was when black soldiers, and in fact non-white soldiers more generally, but specifically black soldiers, started to realize that they were, you know, the shock troops of the empire. And here they were living in a country where they did not have fully human status. I mean, in the 1960s in the United States, black people were still fighting to be seen as fully human. And here they were being deployed around the world to literally murder other folks who were also not white. And I think those connections were very important and, of course, scared the people with power in the United States. We should remember that at that period in U.S. history, people in power were scared about revolution. They really, I mean, in the halls of power in 1968, folks were worried that a full-blown revolution might be emerging in the United States. A lot of that was around that racial consciousness, and I think we have to reclaim that. I think we've lost some of that, and the anti-war movement is one place where we, of course, can raise those issues again.
So what are the prospects that you see for the current occupation in Iraq? It's not looking too good in terms of recruitment, in terms of stability, quote unquote, in Iraq. I mean, all the goals that the administration has set out are really, you know, coming apart in their face. And I know the mass media is doing its best to try and put a positive spin on it, but I don't think anyone can really deny that. So I was just wondering what you see.
Well, certainly the occupation, you know, even mainstream commentators are talking about how we have now lost the Iraq War. I actually wrote a piece, you know, more than a year ago now saying we've lost the Iraq War and that's a good thing. That is not that I was welcoming the loss of life, obviously, but that it was very important for the sake of the world that the U.S. imperial project in Iraq fail, that it be resisted. And unfortunately, it has come with, you know, incredible devastation in Iraq and the loss of human life. You know, the study that was published in the British Medical Journal suggested as many as 100,000 Iraqis dead because of the U.S. invasion. Nobody welcomes that, of course, but it is important that people are starting to recognize there is no way the U.S. can prevail in Iraq. Forget about the moral question or the legal question of should we have gone in, should we be there at all. Just on purely practical grounds, almost everyone outside the Bush administration, I think, acknowledges that the war is a failure. And the only question is what to do about that. Now, unfortunately, much like in Vietnam, the question isn't how do we not only try to get our own troops out, but create at least the possibility of some progress in Iraq. That's not what the mainstream is talking about. They're just talking about kind of cutting our losses and getting out. But it's really, I think, more important for us to talk about what do we owe Iraq now. I think what we owe them, obviously, is the quickest withdrawal of U.S. troops, since U.S. troops create some of the conflict and the tension that leads to the violence. If there needs to be an external military presence in Iraq right now, and you could argue there does need to be some outside force, it clearly should be a U.N. force. And it's clear that the United States should, you know, have no presence in that force, but should fund it, because, of course, it's our invasion that makes it necessary. It's also clear the United States should go forward and pay massive reparations to Iraq for its illegal aggression against the country. Now, if the United States were to actually do that, in a sense, signal to the world it's turning over a new leaf and starting a new path in the world, well, then I think it's a very exciting time. Of course, the possibility of anybody in Washington signing on to that kind of project right now is zero. And I don't just mean the Bush administration. I mean, it's hard to imagine a majority of the Democrats in Congress being able to articulate that level of moral culpability. So it's up to the anti-war movement to push these kinds of ideas, not just get out so that our troops stop dying, not just get out so that the U.S. economy isn't wrecked, but get out and meet our moral obligations to the Iraqi people, and in some sense our moral obligations to the world, to finally acknowledge that the United States government has been, in my lifetime, I would argue, the most serious obstacle to real peace and stability in the world that exists. Not the only obstacle, but certainly one of the most serious obstacles. Now, that's an undertaking for a lifetime, to try and change society to the degree that we could come to that conclusion.
Okay, thank you, Professor Jensen, for speaking with us tonight on the People's Power Hour.
Oh, it's been great to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Well, please stick around, wider listeners. We've got some more news stories coming up for you. And also, too, I think we're going to play that